Okay, so for this, we're missing two of our participants, so we will be calling on then Hope Beentlands, Scientific Director for the National Collaborating Center for Determinants of Health, located in Nova Scotia, to look at credit, financial, well, linking financial empowerment and health equity. Welcome.
Thank you, Hope.
Thank you. It is my distinct pleasure to be here. Can you hear me? Can everybody hear me? Excellent. My preferred way of talking with people is really to get up and wander around. So I understand that there isn't a remote. Is there? Well, I can talk to them.
And if you want, you can tell me to press.
Oh no! Actually, you know what? I'm good. Thank you. I can only handle one change at a time. I was told never to change your slides halfway through, but at lunchtime, instead of having lunch, I went over and changed my slides. So if I try to not only focus on the different slides and then a different way of producing them, I may, in fact, get into real trouble here. So, and again, as Frank knows, I am very technologically challenged here, and I think if I do enter, it'll move forward, right? Perfect. As I mentioned, I am very, very pleased to be here, and I come from the National Collaborating Center for Determinants of Health, and that is located at St. Francis Xavier University in Nova Scotia. In fact, when I suggested that to my economics professor that really I thought economics was smoke and mirrors, and that really it was sort of looking at this little black box and how did you figure out what went in and what came out, I clearly didn't make a very good mark in economics. So I just want you to know I'm not here in any way to because I know anything about economics. I do, however, think that I have some experiences in the healthcare system and in public health that I'd really like to share. I'll just talk very briefly about the Collaborating Center, just so you know sort of what we are about, and then the determinants of health, both the determinants of health and the social determinants of health, because I find that as I speak with people, they're a little bit confused about which are what. And I'm not saying that I have the answers, but I just wanted to sort of lay out the terrain. I'll talk a tiny bit about economic policy and my understanding of income security, and only from a layman's perspective, just trying, again, to put myself in the position of perhaps some of the people who are living in poverty. And if I feel that I am not informed, I can only imagine how perhaps ill-prepared they feel to deal with the economic system that we have. I'll just say a little bit about income security and microcredit. I know just tiny, tiny bits about that. I have no real depth of experience on that one. I do have some ideas that I'm very excited about, though, in terms of microcredit and health equity. And I'm still struggling, as Hans knows, with trying to understand where the social business may become a piece of this. And I hope that the discussion that will follow my presentations, policymakers, and researchers to better understand and to include the research evidence and experiential knowledge that we have about the determinants of health and to have that become and inform both our policy and our public health practice decisions so that they can contribute to health equity and social justice for all. Now, that is a huge mission, and it's much longer than most missions, I realize, but clearly that is an expectation of our center. We are one of the six centers, and our mandate is really to focus on the public health practitioners and policymakers. We do not work with communities directly, but our business is knowledge translation, knowledge synthesis, translation, and exchange. So again, we don't have projects, we're not working in the field, but we're working to build the capacity of public health practitioners in Canada. The determinants of health include the factors such as income and social status, education, employment, and working conditions, access to appropriate health services, and the physical environment. They also include health behaviors and lifestyles, and certainly coping behavior is an important determinant of health. The really interesting and I think the really challenging thing is, though, that we know that the determinants of health work in combination, that it's not any one determinant of health necessarily that you can single out as having any one impact or effect on health. But it's all of these determinants working together to create different living conditions which impact our health and, as a result, inequity in health across Canada. This is a list of the determinants of health. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I just felt it was important to put up the Public Health Agency of Canada's list just for context. And the determinant of health that I want to focus mostly on is healthy child development, because I believe that there's a real opportunity to influence health equity by focusing on early child development. Everybody here, I'm sure, is very aware of the WHO Commission on the Social Determinants of Health, both the interim report and the final report. And as many of you will also know, Michael Marmot actually defines the social determinants of health as the broad institutional factors that exert influence on the health of groups of people within society, because they are deeply entrenched in the social order and the related structure of opportunities and constraints that are or can be accessed by individuals. So, in other words, the social determinants of health or our health inequities are socially constructed and don't have to be. The WHO Commission overarching recommendations were three. One was to improve the daily living conditions of individuals around the world. The second one was to tackle the inequitable distribution of power, money, and resources. And the third is to measure and understand the problem and to assess the impact of the action. Not a little job, either. None of them. Huge challenges. But if we think about and take seriously the opportunity and the challenge of improving daily conditions or daily living conditions, the WHO Commission suggested that we really need to focus on improving the well-being of girls and women and the circumstances in which their children are born. And when we were in the Grameen Bank Creative Lab, we talked about some opportunities that might be happening around the birthing conditions for women, which were, I think, hold lots of promise. Another way to improve daily living conditions is to put major emphasis on early child development. So you can see that we are, in fact, listening and sort of moving forward on that one here in the National Collaborating Center. Another opportunity is to put major emphasis on education for girls and boys and to improve both working and living conditions. So it's not just the living conditions, but also it's the conditions in which families work. Another way is to create social protection policies supportive of everyone and to create conditions for which we can grow old and age in place and to have a flourishing older life. We need policies that will involve civil society, governments, and global institutions. I think one of the reasons that I was asked to participate in this think tank was that a recognition that government cannot do it all. We have to do this as a collaborative, as a collective. And so we clearly, another really important action is to tackle the inequitable distribution of power, money, and resources. And this is everybody's job. It's not just the job of government. We need to address inequities such as those between men and women in the way societies are organized. We need to strengthen governance, legitimacy, space. We need to have people agree to across society and reinvest in the value of collective action. And we need an accountable private sector, and I think we've been hearing lots about social business, which I think is one way to respond to the desire to have an accountable private sector. The next thing we need to do is measure and understand the problem and to assess the impact of our actions. So it's really, really important that we do something, but it's also important that we measure the impact of what we do. So the first thing we need to do, though, is to acknowledge that there is a problem, that there is a need to do something, that we do need to change. We need to ensure that health inequity is measured. And I know there's some challenges around how to do that. I don't profess to have the answers, but one of the things that our center is contributing to is working with the Public Health Agency of Canada and the Population Health Promotion Expert Group to try to identify these measures so that we can, in fact, measure what is happening. We need to establish a global health equity surveillance system for routine monitoring, and we also need to evaluate the health equity impact of policy and action. We need to invest in the training of policymakers and health practitioners. We certainly heard lots this day and a half around the importance of the training for people involved in microcredit and in social business. So clearly we need to do the same in the health sector. We need to increase public understanding of the social determinants of health. And the reason I'm not here today, going to be here tomorrow, is in fact we're having a conversation around how do we talk about, or how do we language the social determinants of health so it will resonate with the economists, with the policymakers, with people working in industry, with the unions, etc. And we also need to increase our focus on the social determinants of health in public health research. There is a real dearth of research in the effectiveness of the public health interventions. And I know that certainly in Quebec you're doing some really outstanding work in terms of the what we call the intervention research led by Louise Potvin and some of her colleagues. But we clearly need to have more of that in Canada. I think probably, again, everybody will recognize these documents. They are three of the Knowledge Network documents that supported the WHO Commission. They are the Knowledge Network document on women and gender equity, early child development, employment conditions, and health inequities. And again, these are the three sort of fundamental documents that we have used at the National Collaborating Center to try to determine how we can best support our public health practitioners to address health inequity. This is a model, I'm not going to try to explain it, but it's a model that was developed by Clyde Hertzman. And basically what I really want to say is that each of the sphere of influence on early child development is depicted here. And it means that everything actually impacts the on child development. The home environment, the community environment, the neighborhood environment, the environment, the cultural environment that a child is reared in, these are all really, really important. And the other thing that this model depicts is the fact that it takes more than parents to provide a nurturing environment for children, that there is a responsibility for communities and provinces and countries as well, that it's really important that we create the conditions for healthy child development. The reason that our center is looking at this model quite actively is we want to determine if it has utility for public health practice. Right now it's a conceptual model, it really hasn't been tested in the field, but much of the public health practice is not necessarily based on theoretical concepts. It's based on ways of doing things over years and years of experience. And we feel that it's really important to bring evidence into that practice of public health. One of the principles that is really important is that the interaction between the child and their environment or environments are important. And we need to start to understand that better. Certainly, we know that environments shape the child, but we also know that children shape the environment, so that it's a two-way interaction. We know that successful early child development occurs when environments are nurturing. There is a huge body of research and evidence to support that. The other reason that our center likes this model is that it's equity-based, and that is fundamental to the way that we need to move forward. We know that healthy child development is really important because the effect of prenatal and early childhood experiences on subsequent health, well-being, coping skills, and competence is very powerful. There is SCADS, there's just document, volume after volume of research that demonstrates the importance of good prenatal care and nurturing environments. How does poverty impact child health? We know in Canada that the high infant mortality, 6.5 per 1,000 children who die every year in the poorest quintile, or poorest one-fifth of our Canadian urban neighborhoods, is very different from the 3.9 per 1,000 children who die in our richest 20% of Canadian urban populations. This is Canada. And I would suggest that this difference is unacceptable. We need to figure out what to do about this. And I think that some of the ideas that have been shared yesterday and today hold promise and certainly give me hope. So I'm really excited about some of the opportunities. When children live in poverty, we know that they have more antisocial behavior. There are more conduct behavior problems, hyperactivity and inattention, as well as other behavioral challenges. This is well documented. We also know, based on 2004-2005 statistics, that 8% or 684,000 Canadian families are poor. They're living in poverty. And that's based on the LICO. And again, I meant to find out exactly what that was for Canada, but I neglected to do that at lunchtime. We also know that 12%, or nearly 800,000 Canadian children, are living in poverty. That's a lot of kids. And we also know that just under one half of all the poor children live in lone parent families. Usually the head of household is the mother, but not always. And we also know that if they had less than $10,000, they could bring themselves above the poverty line. So herein, is there an opportunity for some of the microfinancing schemes that we've talked about or some of the other innovative ways of putting money in the hands of these families? Is that a possibility? And is there an opportunity here to really address this issue? We know, and this is shameful, but we know that 49% of recent immigrant families live in poverty. We know that 40% of off-reserve First Nations children live in poverty. And we know that 34% of children who are poor are invisible minority families. And the other thing that we know, and it's really exciting, is that in Quebec, child poverty has consistently fallen over the last 10 years. So we know it can change. It does not have to be the way it is. And I applaud and congratulate Quebec for their outstanding policies and commitment to children. I just only hope that the rest of us can follow your example. Now, here's where I get into really shaky ground. If I look and think about economic policy, and this is just what it means to me, sort of like in the back of an envelope in a restaurant, you know, when I don't have anybody interesting to talk to, I think of economic policy as those broad-ranging, high-level policies, i.e. trade policy, like a free trade, maybe it's the whether or not our lending rate, what do you call that, the interest rate goes up or down. To me, that's a or an economic policy. It seems to me that the impact is frequently longer term rather than immediate, and that for most individuals, it has limited relevance. Like, people may hear that it's happening, but they don't really relate to what it really means to them today or tomorrow. They may just know that they don't have enough food on the table, or they can't afford to buy that pair of shoes that is so important, because it gets cold here in Canada in the winter. We don't have hookworm, but we still have other challenges. We also, to me, economic policy relates to financial, this financial, it's, it relates to financial status of individuals, but over the longer term. And it really doesn't immediately impact families living in poverty. That all of our economic policies seem to have little impact on the number of people who are living in poverty. As I say, that's from a naive, on-the-street perspective. Income security and microcredit, though, seems to be easier to understand. And I'm not saying it's simple, because it's obviously very complex. But I can get my simple mind around it more easily. It seems to me to have direct relevance to family and individual. Like there's a direct focus at the individual family. And I think also at the community level. And I think it meets a critical need. And I think that it is one way to address financial security. It is not the only way. It cannot be the only way. But I think it can start to address it. It has some promise. I think there could be a significant link or relationship between financial security. Well, I'm sorry. We know that there is a significant relationship between financial security and health. And I think there could be a link between microcredit and health equity. I think that there's an opportunity to link health with financial interventions. This traditionally has not really been done, or certainly not effectively been done in most provinces in Canada. I think there's an opportunity to make microcredit loans to families with young children. And I'm not suggesting that every young mother or father is an entrepreneur, but there's certainly, I know there are some out there. And the challenge is to find them and perhaps identify them. And if we can provide the kind of support that we've heard about over the last couple of days in the microfinance and some of the microfinance finance schemes, I think there is some opportunity to really try this out and determine, measure whether or not it works. I think it's really, really important to focus on early child development as a determinant of health. And there are figures, economic figures, that suggest that every dollar invested on a child will return either between $7 to even, I think I saw one figure of almost $18 per child, per dollar invested. This, again, is hard to measure, and there's not a consistency around that, but it's clear that you more than double your investment, for sure. And again, I would just challenge us all to think about the opportunities. In microcredit, it's my understanding that financial survival is a priority. In other words, and certainly that was confirmed over the last couple of days, is that it's important that the microfinance institution is viable. It expects to get its money repaid. It expects to make a profit. And the piece that I didn't know is that there's an expectation around savings, which I think is brilliant. There is evidence to suggest that it is both effective in low- and middle-income countries. And we also know that loan repayment, or default on loan repayment, is very low. We do know, though, it can have some negative health impacts, but I think these can be mitigated. And I think that the more experience that people have had with microcredit, in fact, I think many of these health or negative health impacts have already been mitigated. And the kinds of things I'm referring to are some of the work that was done in Vietnam, where they were loaning money for pottery, local pottery businesses or industry, and some of the chemicals that they were using were very harmful to health. I think we know that when microfinance or microcredit started, in some of the situations, the women actually just doubled their workload instead of actually having any real benefit from the microcredit. But they, I think that it sounds from what I've learned the last 2 days that this also has been mitigated. There is no question that microcredit can increase family income. And it also can create financial empowerment. We've heard example after example of that. And again, I would just ask us to think of the opportunities. This is not a mistake. I put this slide in here the second time just again to really focus that it was it takes less than $10,000 to make a difference in the lives of poor children in Canada. And these are some questions I would just like to finish with. Does microcredit have anything to offer? What does it have to offer? Can it address the children in Canada, particularly in lone parent families, who require less than $10,000 to bring them above the poverty line? So I ask you, what are the possibilities? And I'd just like to acknowledge the Public Health Agency who funds our center. And that's where you can get in touch with me.
Thank you.